Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We love to celebrate the accomplishments of young people in our culture. Every year you find lists of 30 under 30 doing something or 40 under 40 doing something else. For the last 10 years, the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier has been taking some time to honor the accomplishments of people who are 80 years old or older. This hour, we'll get to know some of the people honored by the Courier. Nancy Newhoff is editor of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier, and she is with me now. Hello, Nancy.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And how did this series come about? Where did the idea come from?
It's got a little interesting little story. So we were doing one of the 20 under 40s. We've been doing that for 20-some years now, celebrating those. Our publisher at the time, David Brayton, said to me, just in a passing, we were either having coffee or something, he said, why are we not celebrating the legacy of people in this community? And we looked at each other, and I said, I don't know. So thus it began. It's really a legacy honor for those who are 80 and over, and it has been so successful. It is just loved by the community. We hear more about it than about anything we do.
I can imagine. And of course, this is a time in life when a lot of people, most people, are retired, and in many ways, they're not getting the kind of recognition that they've gotten throughout their lives. I mean, you have profiled so many people with remarkable careers, but is it hard to find these people since they may not be as active as they once were?
Surprisingly, it's very easy. We get, I would say, about 70 to 100 nominations. It is almost overwhelming at times. Some people will have multiple nominations on behalf of them. Maybe now that people are getting used to it, they may get one person may say, ask several friends, please write a letter on their behalf, a nomination. But really, for the committee to look at it, the more depth they have in the nomination, it is very hard to pare it down to 8. That's one of the tasks that we have a community group do for us. We don't pick them. We have some community leaders come together and do it for us. But no, it is not hard to get nominations. And these are people we may have heard of over the years, but they may be people that were very behind the scenes doing a lot of things in this community that didn't always make news.
What kind of guidance do you give those committee members? How do they select the people who are honored?
We have our criteria says that we are seeking people who demonstrate leadership. They are contributing now or in the past to the betterment of the community, and often behind the scenes, those who continue to be a success and or have been a role model or mentor to others. So when we get all the nominations in, we repeat that to them, and it really helps guide them. I've had my committee is made up of I have 2 past winners on it, so they kind of have a really good feel of what we're looking for.
Once you have selected those 8 people, and in the Courier, you publish profiles of them. So that's a wonderful opportunity to really get to know them. That must be a fascinating process.
It is. It's even more fun than that. We write a story on them. We do a video on them, and we photograph them. And we compile it all into a Cedar Valley Business Monthly magazine. But then one of the most popular parts of it is we have a luncheon, and it's in June, and it's about the time the magazine comes out, and we then bring all of them together. There's a luncheon, and their families are there, and each one comes up and speaks, and that is sometimes the most incredible part of it. People are raptured by the voices of these people who are in their 80s, and they're funny. They look back. They're humble. They're all these different things. But it is the luncheon is really the most to me popular part of the whole thing. Then we take those stories that are in that magazine and reprint them in the Courier over the following week, so that it touches as many people as we can. We try to get their stories out to as many as possible.
Have you been surprised by how powerful this experience has been for you?
Yes, and I often tell them that each year. I said this is really one of the most memorable things I do every year, is getting this class of people together, this class of eight together. I get to call each one of them, tell them. I set up the picture. I interview them for the video. The reporter will write the story. But I've gotten to know all these people over the years. And then we take a moment each year also at the luncheon to remember those who've passed. And we do lose a couple every year. We had a tough year this year. We lost six over the past year. And we'd go all the way back to the beginning. So since the beginning of 8 over 80, you know, these are the ones we lost in the past year. And we have a little prayer for them, and I think the audience really likes that, too.
Does it make you think a lot about what you'll be like when you're over 80?
No, but I did joke with them this year and said, I've been doing this so long now, I'm going to be one of these pretty soon. No, it doesn't. But it is so fun to see their families there, their children and grandchildren, and really get to honor them while they're still viable and give wonderful speeches.
And so many of them are still so active. That's one of the things that strikes me. Have you been surprised by just how much these people are contributing to their community still in their 80s?
Sometimes I'm stunned. I was like, that at the energy level of the at some of these recipients, they're bounding upstairs. It's just it's been an eye-opening experience for that, but it's in a wonderful way. You know that we aren't forgetting these people. These people are still playing an important role in our community.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you saw it and enjoyed it. And I hope other communities do it. I think they should.
Nancy Newhoff is editor of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. And with me now is Len Froyen. He is a longtime resident of the Cedar Valley, a professor emeritus of educational psychology at the University of Northern Iowa, the author of Gratitude, Affirming One Another Through Stories, and co-author of Gateway to Forgiveness and Beyond. And he is here with me now. Hello, Len.
Good afternoon, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And in reading about your life in the profile that was published in the Waterloo Courier, I get the impression that your interest in psychology goes well beyond your professional interest in psychology, which made me wonder, what was it that drew you into the field in the first place?
I enjoy people, and I enjoy understanding how we function as people, and the way in which we can be more effective in the ways in which we deal and belong to one another.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Clarion, Iowa, small rural town where you knew just about everybody and everybody knew you. And I think that's another reason I got interested in psychology, because I had an opportunity in a small community to get to know the people who were part of that community, particularly through my father, who was a baker, owned a bakery in Clarion. And I had a chance to meet people early in the morning when I was there, working with my father, and listening to and visiting with people who were part of the community, leaders in the community, and listening to the way in which they went about their work and the way they went about trying to be of service to people in that community.
So you were already studying subjects while you were selling bread.
That's true, and I didn't think of it that way, but that's a good way to put it.
So as you went into the field of psychology, of course, you spent many years teaching at the University of Northern Iowa, but your work as a published author has focused on gratitude and forgiveness. What drew you specifically to those areas?
Early in my career as a deacon, I became responsible for the formation program for deacons in the Archdiocese of Dubuque. And as part of that program, we would have periods of reflection at the end of each day. And during those periods of reflection, we would talk about the topics of that day or talk about various facets of our relationships with others. And on one such occasion, the group talked about their relationship in their marriages. And they began to visit with one another about what made their marriages special. And during the course of the conversation, they began to talk about the significance of gratitude. And as they did, I became very fascinated with the various dimensions of gratitude and how that particular virtue is expressed in our relationships, particularly in intimate relationships. So the book basically came out of personal stories, people in my lives who taught me something about the way in which they were using their lives.
When did you become a deacon?
I became a deacon in 1989, and I was assigned by the Archbishop to the Catholic Student Center here at the University of Northern Iowa.
What led you to become a deacon? It sounds like you already had your professional plate very full. What led you to want to pursue that pathway as well?
Well, initially it was becoming much more interested in the spiritual dimensions of life, of trying to better understand the way in which we are feeling people, the way in which feelings kind of influence the way in which we go about making decisions. And I think of ourselves as basically spiritual beings, as persons who first and foremost, when making a decision, begin with a feeling, begin with taking something from life and trying to understand what it's like as a feeling, and then begin to ask the question, what do I think of it? Why do I feel this particular way? How does it contribute to the way in which I see myself and the way in which I see others? And that gradually led me into the whole area of forgiveness as well, trying to understand better the power of forgiveness to influence the way in which we connect with one another.
I'm talking with Len Froyen, Professor Emeritus of Educational Psychology at the University of Northern Iowa and one of 2019's 8 Over 80, a group of remarkable Iowans honored by the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. We'll hear more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're meeting some of the people honored by the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier in their 2019 class of 8 over 80. Before the break, I was talking with Len Froyen. He's a professor emeritus of educational psychology at the University of Northern Iowa. And before the break, we were talking about his work as a deacon for the Catholic Church. And Len, you decided to become a deacon, but when you made that decision, you weren't necessarily focused on the service you could provide others. This was also part of a personal journey, wasn't it?
You have seen it perfectly. And that is, initially, it was something I was going to do for myself. And as I got into it, I realized that becoming a deacon wasn't something you do for yourself. It's something you do to be available to others, trying to find some way to enter the lives of others, to connect yourselves with others, and to, in the case of being a deacon, connecting themselves to God, and to find in their relationship with God something special in themselves. What is unique about themselves, and what do they have to offer others?
The way you talk about your work as a guidance counselor and as a professor of educational psychology sounds so similar to the way that you're talking about your work as a deacon. Did you find a lot of parallels? I mean, we think about sort of the psychology and the scientific approach to the mind as being different from the spiritual approach to the mind.
Well, as a deacon, I was also able to preach the gospel. So in addition to doing the counseling work, working with individual students, many times they came to me in the first place because they saw me on the altar. They could see my spiritual life being lived out in the Mass. They could see my spiritual life being lived out in my preaching, trying to use the gospel of a way of helping to understand their relationship with God, their relationship with others, and to help them to understand that there's something more to life than what goes on each day.
I don't want to in any way imply that you're not still journeying, because it sounds like you are continuing to search and evolve and learn new things. But if you had to choose right now, what would you want your legacy to be?
I think my legacy would be one of learning how to be grateful. I wrote the book on gratitude because I think it is the most important virtue in our lives. I think it is the prelude to every other virtue in our lives. So if I could give a young person one word, a vocabulary that will serve them for all of the other virtues in life, whether it be kindness or patience or compassion, it's gratitude, because gratitude is the foundation for all other virtues. So if I could get a student to take that one word and to every day when they get up, begin to think of their day intentionally as a day in which they're going to be grateful for what they have been given and for what they can do.
Do you do that every day?
I do that every day. I don't get out of bed in the morning until I've given some thought to the day ahead of me and what I'm going to try to do during that day to express my gratitude, to express the relationship qualities in other people that affirm me and affirm them.
You have shared the stories of many others in your work about gratitude. Can you tell me one story right now about your life, a moment when you really fully understood the power of gratitude?
I think the first story in my book helped me write the rest of the book because it had such a powerful impact on my life. And it's a story about my grandfather, and I titled the chapter Acceptance because it was a time when I felt fully accepted by another person. My grandfather was the milkman in a small community in Litchfield, North Dakota, and he delivered milk with a horse and buggy. And I would go out with him in the summer, and we would deliver milk. And I sat alongside him on this leather bench and watched him take care of the horse in front of us and make our way through this small community, and giving me an opportunity to do things with him and to feel the whole sense of being part of a community that depended upon him for this one service in their lives. And we would visit with one another as we would go from one house, but I felt like I was being drawn into what it meant to be an adult and being done so gradually. So as I write the story in the book, I gradually talk about that relationship, and then I use the relationship to talk about gratitude, how gratitude was graciously being formed in the time that we spent together. So it was basically an experience of unconditional acceptance and to feel how that is resonating in my own life, how to be accepting of others.
What does it mean to you to be selected as one of the 8 over 80 this year?
Well, it was remarkable. It meant that, you know, someone had to nominate me, and probably somebody wrote some letters of and I think that it said to me in a sense that the things that I've been trying to do that many times go unrecognized, in some way underneath it all have been recognized. And there is something to be said for doing things for others and with others that amounts to something, that it makes you feel like you've mattered in some way, that your life has done something that is worth celebrating.
Len, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I appreciate having the opportunity to visit with you.
And congratulations again.
Thank you.
My next guest was honored by the Courier last year. Lorraine Griffey has had a long career of service, first military service, and after she left the military, she found many other ways to serve, fighting for equal education opportunities for all children in Chicago. She worked with the Iowa Department of Public Health as program manager for the culturally specific HIV and AIDS prevention program. She co-founded the Cedar Valley Coalition of Black Veterans and the Sister Soldier Network, which is a multi-state organization devoted to enhancing the visibility of advocates for service for African-American military women. And she still works part-time for Bakari Behavioral Health Incorporated. She is with me on the line. Lorraine, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
You are an incredibly busy woman. And of course, you wouldn't be part of this group if you weren't over 80 years old. Have you had a hard time saying no and slowing down a little bit in these golden years?
Well, I had to practice it. I used to tell my sister when we'd go on vacation that I'd stand in front of the mirror and just say no, 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 because it was hard to do. Once you're into helping and doing things, it's hard to say no sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to go way back in time to talk about your time in the military, because I get the sense that really shaped you and helped you develop this desire to help others. When you were growing up in Chicago and in Waterloo, I'm sure you experienced discrimination, but you didn't really encounter large-scale segregation until you joined the military. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience, that kind of culture shock, was like for you traveling south?
It really was a culture shock. I had never been aware of being segregated, I think, until that time. Even though I know it existed up until then, I was never part of, you know, just experiencing it for myself. And leaving here, leaving Iowa, on the train that took me to Fort Lee, Virginia, for basic training, when the train crossed the Mason-Dixon line, all people of color had to get off and take the rear car to our destination. That was my very first encounter, because we stopped the train stations. The depots were definitely marked, colored and white. And then we began to know where you could go and what you could do. It was my first experience with that. And it was a culture shock. It was something I had not anticipated or was even aware of, really. I was 18, 19 years old, and coming from Iowa, I just had not been in that position before.
And life was very different for you on the military base, because the military bases had been ordered to be integrated. So it was when you left the base that you encountered that stark segregation and those rules that you hadn't had to live under before.
Right. We were told when we left the base, there were certain areas in the city. If we went into the city, we had leave. There were certain areas that people of color were bounded by. That was a very new experience. Coming from Waterloo, you know, we didn't have that here. And so it was something really new.
When you came back north and you lived in Chicago, how did those experiences down south change your view as you looked around the world that you were living in up north and raising your kids in?
It made me more aware of what our living situation really was. Of course, being a person of color and my children, when they started school, and we found out that they were still reading out of history books that were published in the 30s and 40s. They had not been updated. These were mid-50s, just before the civil rights began. And that was something that made me truly take notice, that, you know, my children were not getting the kind of education that I had hoped they would. Coming from Iowa, at the time, Iowa was one of the top educational, had the best education in the country, was one of those. And so I wanted that for my children, too. And it didn't exist there in Chicago in the school system, because primarily the schools where my children went were primarily children of color.
So you and other members of the PTA took a very active role in changing that, right?
Yes, we did. We did. I became part of an organization that organized the largest school boycott that Chicago had ever known. We kept 250,000 children out of school, and we burned those books in front of the Board of Education building.
Wow. Lorraine, I think we could spend hours talking about so much of the work you've done in your life. I want to fast forward to some of the work you've done with Black veterans in recent years and women of color who've served in the military. You co-founded the Cedar Valley Coalition of Black Veterans and the Sister Soldier Network. What did you see? What did you experience that made you feel like you needed to be part of creating an organization that would support those veterans?
Well, as I've met younger women who have served recently in the military and been exposed to actual warfare, they too had suffered from post-traumatic stress. And it's not been, attention has not been on them as it has been on the males. And we just needed to do something. Women have served in the military ever since this country has been involved in any kind of military situation. And people of color have been part of that. And we needed to begin to recognize that and give women the recognition that they deserve and the help that they deserve. That organization was founded in order as a support system to try to help them and let them know that what benefits are available to them, and so that we could help them be recognized for the service that they gave.
Can you share a little bit of your personal philosophy? It feels like in your life, when you have seen something that you feel is a problem, you've asked yourself what you can do to fix it. Can you tell me a little bit about your thought process and how you look around the world?
Well, today more than ever, I think we need to do what we can to reach out to each other to help make this country what they've always said it was. It's difficult for people of color because we've not always been included to help. Well, we have always helped, but we've not been recognized for the help we've given. It's important that we continue to try to help make this country what they started it out to be. And that has always included people of color. There were people of color here when Europeans came and started this country. So we need to always recognize those people and give them their due. And we're entitled to that. All of us are entitled to that.
You have such a full life with grandkids and great-grandkids. Is there a lesson that you want your great-grandkids to learn from you and what you've done and carry forward?
I want them, of course, to look forward to the best life they can have. And in order to do that, they have to be the best people they can be. And I want to help them do that as long as I'm here. And then I want them to be able to pay that forward. And that includes everybody, that they can be kind to people and that they can resonate kindness and that they can do what they need to do to be the best citizens of this country.
Lorraine, what did it mean to you to be honored by the Waterloo Courier, to have just a small portion of your story told?
I was totally surprised. I had not expected to even be chosen when I was when they reached out to me to ask would it be okay if they submitted my name. I thought about it at first, and I thought, well, no, because I really hadn't done that much that I thought deserved the recognition. And I agreed because I never thought I'd be chosen. So I was totally surprised, but very honored.
Well, Lorraine, I hope you can see how much you've done to deserve recognition, because clearly you have done so much in your life. But thank you so much for talking with me today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Lorraine Griffey, she was honored in the 2018 class of 8 over 80 by the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. And in a moment, we'll meet two more members of the 2019 class. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting to know some of the individuals selected by the Waterloo Courier as this year's class of 8 over 80. My next guest is Marie Nitzke. And if you don't know Marie, I can help you create a mental picture. In recent years, she has started playing Mrs. Claus around Christmas time, and she perfectly looks the part. She is being honored for the many ways she has made a difference in the lives of those with special needs over the years. And her service grew out of a very personal experience. She is with me on the line now. Hello, Marie.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're most welcome.
And Marie, I know that you have 7 daughters, so you've been a busy woman for your entire life, but your service with people with special needs came about because of your daughter, Anita. Tell me about Anita.
Anita, she was handicapped, and she could not talk, and she still is 60 years old this year, and she does not talk. And she, we had the, back in the 60s, there was no school. You know, when Anita was here, there was no River Hills, and she needed speech, and we put her through all the schooling that we could get her to go through. And we went to Sacred Heart for 2 years as a kindergarten. We went to Longfellow through a year of that. They would not take her back a second year, so we had to find something else. And we lost Wayne Morris, who was her speech teacher. And he said that he thought that she had said a word for him, but he left town. So we were sitting with nothing. Wow. The other girls in school, and Anita couldn't go to school. And Dr. Hansen said, well, there is a school at Woodward. So we made arrangements to take Anita to Woodward.
Back in those days, as you said, in the 1960s, when Anita was little, you didn't have very many options. So you had to send her away from home to get her the kind of help that she needed. Is that what drove your volunteer service? Were you thinking, I want to make things better for other families with children with special needs?
Yes, yes. And then I felt I had to repay God for the volunteer work that somebody else did, so I decided I better get into doing volunteer work. I'd never volunteered in my life before that.
Well, so, I can't imagine that you had any time to volunteer with 7 little girls at home.
Right.
So as you got involved in volunteering, it sounds like it became a really, really big part of your life. What did it mean to you to be able to do that?
Well, it's great just to get a smile from somebody. You know, you help them and you do something for them. And I mean,
you noticed that the young people or the people that were living in these group homes often didn't have the clothes that they needed, or their clothes didn't fit right, right?
Yes. If you see them, you come into a grocery store and they're there with their staff person. And there's three, what really got me is I saw 3 fellows, and one was a little guy, and, you know, he pulled up his pants. Before I got to the register, he had to pull it up again three times. And I said, this is unacceptable. You know, this is what we have to do. We have to make their clothes look perfect. They have enough against them to start with. So we want them to look perfect in public, and we want them perfect at home and comfortable with that, you know. Yeah, they have to have pride.
Yeah. And you came up with a fun name for this organization of volunteers. You call yourselves the Gophers and the Gopherettes?
Yeah, well, there's the Minnesota Gophers, you know, so that football team. So I named the guys Gophers, and I said, I can't call the women Gophers. So I made it Gopherettes. So that's how we got it.
And you are still sewing, right?
Yes, yes. Oh, we had it so wonderful when we first started. We were able to go into the homes, and we would work right straight through. And the first one was like 9 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. We had two big bushels of all these badly damaged clothes. It was really neat to do, yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, you've been doing all of this volunteer work with the Ark of the Cedar Valley and with EPI, Exceptional Persons, for so many years. You also, in recent years, have started playing Mrs. Claus. Tell me how that came about.
Well, we were at the cookie walk, and his mother came in with her boy, and he was short, you know, and he looked up at me, and he kind of darted and took his head over towards his mother's hip and went on by, and I thought, oh, I'm kind of bashful. And then when they started to go out, he was on the other side, and he was ducking away from me, and she said, he thinks you're Mrs. Claus. So I said, okay, I am. So then at the next board meeting with the joint volunteers, I said, a little boy thought I was Mrs. Claus. They said, well? I said, okay. So I looked it up on the net, and oh my gosh, the clothing to be Mrs. Claus is very expensive. And I thought, I don't know if I want to do that. So I went to the fabric store and bought some yardage. And
yeah, I think you have some sewing skills, right?
So I sewed it up on one side and one on the other, and I went back down the basement, and I found my fur, and I put a band of white fur around the bottom, and became Mrs. Claus.
So you've been doing this for about 10 years. Where do you play Mrs. Claus?
Oh, at the cookie walk. We go from the cookie walk to the bowling alley for EPI's Christmas party for the bowlers. And then I go from there over to, after working cookie walk, then I do the bowling alley. And then I go to PetSmart and I hold animals.
Tell me what it means to you to be selected as one of the 8 over 80 this year.
That's hard to say. I'm honored, but I think it's a good thing to do, and it was a tremendous event. All my family came home, and we had Nina there, and she was just as good as gold, and let me get up on the stage without fussing. So.
And it's just lovely to see such a public recognition of all of the work you've done for so many years, Marie. I'm sure that you have touched so many lives.
It's humbling to sit there and listen to what all these other people have done. Then you think, oh, you haven't done much. You know,
I don't think that's true.
Well, you know, but it is humbling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, Marie, and thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you. I'd like to meet you someday.
Yeah, I bet we could make that happen sometime.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thank you so much, Marie.
All right, thank you, Charity.
Yeah, bye-bye. And my next guest is Joy Teal. Joy had a long career as a teacher in Rhinebeck and Waterloo. She made a permanent mark on a number of schools developing their school libraries. And when she retired, she knew she didn't want to stop working and has volunteered with more gusto than a lot of other people bring to their paid work. Joy is with me on the line. Hello, Joy.
Hello, Chastity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And first of all, Joy, how long ago did you retire?
22 years ago would be in June, so it was just a couple months over.
Wow, 22 years ago. And at that point, how many years had you been a teacher?
40.
40 years as a teacher.
Yes.
And
yes,
now
I had been.
22 years as a volunteer. You knew before you retired that you really wanted to volunteer in those years. Why was that?
Well, my parents, we lived on a farm, and my parents are big volunteer people, and they actually, they just showed me how wonderful volunteering is and all the wonderful things that you get back in by doing it. So I just knew I would have a next life after retirement. It was going to be volunteering.
When you were watching your parents volunteer, can you remember some of the things they did that you thought, oh, I really want to be able to do that someday?
They worked a lot with young people. My parents had two daughters, myself and my sister. Yet my father was a boys, 4-H club leader for about 20 years.
So when you did retire, you started out volunteering at the gift shop at Allen Hospital in Waterloo.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
And what did you love about that?
The people. Everyone was so nice to me, and everybody that you worked with was nice and friendly. And I'd done enough clerking before in my sister's drugstore that I was familiar with cash registers, so it was just an easy thing to start doing.
All right. And, of course, you're dealing with people, a lot of people, who are not having a very good time because they're at the hospital visiting a loved one. Did you find that you, even though you were just ringing up purchases, did you find that you had an opportunity to really help people who were going through a difficult time?
Oh, yes, definitely. One of my favorite things that I did more than once, but you get million-dollar paychecks every so often, and this is one of my million-dollar paychecks.
What do you mean?
Was in, yeah. And their family came in, and they had a loved one upstairs. It was non-responsive, and they just wanted to get her something. They didn't know what to do. I said, okay, you get her a stuffed animal. Well, they looked at me as a stuffed animal for a little old lady, you know. And so I talked them into getting him a stuffed animal, taking it up to their mother, laying it beside her face, and petting that stuffed animal with her hand. Later that day, they came in, and they told me that that's the first that their mother had responded, and she was talking to them then.
Oh,
that was my million-dollar paycheck for giving them that advice, and that they came back and told me how it had worked.
Oh, what a beautiful moment. So you were volunteering in the gift shop, but you didn't want to stop there. You've also volunteered with a number of libraries, right?
Emmanuel Lutheran School needed a librarian, and they wanted to start a more formal library than they had on a computer. And so during the time I was working at Allen, I also was at Emmanuel School. And I have worked in our nursing home for approximately the whole 22 years here, helping out and doing activities there. So I just always found lots of things to do at the same time. I never worked only one job. I've always had more than one place to work.
You also volunteer at the Grout Museum in Waterloo. Tell me what you do at the museum.
Well, I'm kind of a jack of all trades there, but one of my fun things is I get to help them teach museum school. That's third grade. It comes from Waterloo, Cedar Falls schools and some of the area schools around. And they have a half-day session, and as each school goes through, then when I'm there helping them teach the third graders, I also do data entry for them. I do filing for them, whatever they need, and I'm there doing it.
Mm-hmm. So you're still teaching in many ways.
Want to keep teaching as long as I can. I'm loving it. You get so many, like I said, million-dollar paychecks when something happens.
Well,
special little things that happen to you.
Yeah. So if you put together the 40 years you spent teaching and getting paid for it and 22 years volunteering and teaching, that's a 62-year teaching career.
Right. And I'm getting ready to go back this fall.
Oh, that's wonderful. So tell me a little bit more about museum school. What kinds of things are you teaching the kids about?
They have 4 different classes in a half a day. And of course, we rotate the 4 groups around that. They do simple machines. They tour the Rensselaer House, which is an old house, you know, all the artifacts and things that we've got in there. We do pioneers. We do Indians. We do, I was trying to think something. Oh, the astronomy.
So
the house of back in the prairie times.
Well, and you don't go back to prairie times, Joy, but you grew up on a farm in Iowa 80 years ago. So
more than that.
do you find yourself sharing your personal experience with the children?
Yes, I get one of those opportunities. Well, I do it quite often, actually. But during one of the times that we have a museum school, there's always some extra time so that I can share the activities that I did and how we farmed with a team of horses and how big they were. So, yes, every week I get to share some of those things. And they've also, they had last year, which is the first year they've done it, and I got to teach that. And I got that, I taught myself because I was the only one there. It was first graders, and it was pioneers and how did they get to Iowa. So I could tell them about starting in New York and the covered wagons and coming across. And I can relate because I've seen in the sod houses, we had sod houses just about a mile away from the farm I lived on.
Wow.
So I've seen a lot of those things.
Joy, for other people who are retired or maybe thinking about retiring, what would you like them to know about the rewards that you can get from volunteering?
Every day I come home with a smile on my face. Every day I feel needed. Every day I am healthy because I've got my mind busy, my body's busy if I'm walking out my door, and the rewards are just bushels and bushels and bushels. There's no stopping all those rewards that you get with working with people. And I've worked with I've always worked with wonderful people. But here I come in, little old lady that maybe doesn't know what she's doing when they walk in for a volunteer job, and they take me under their wing, and they're wonderful to work with. Think of what we got out there for wonderful people.
Joy, what does it mean to you to be recognized as one of 8 over 80 this year? It's a lovely honor.
Actually, floored. You know, I'm doing this volunteering because I want to, because I like to, because I've had so many wonderful new experiences that are just precious to me. I never dreamt I'd get awards. I've had some other awards, too, but this is a big one. And I just think, why would you give me an award? I'm doing what I want to do.
Well, Joy, congratulations. Thank you for
Thank
all
you.
That you do. And I think you've given us all a lot of goals to reach for. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so very much.
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Shirley Wong, Dennis Reese, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can listen anytime by subscribing to the Talk of Iowa podcast. Just search for Talk of Iowa wherever you get your podcasts. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.